The opinions and views expressed in Dead Men Do Tell Tales and all affiliated media are Jordan and Nicole's and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of their training program or others working in the field of medico-legal death investigation.
Hey everyone, welcome to Dead Men Do Tell Tales,
a podcast about forensic pathology related topics.
I'm Nicole Kroom.
And I'm Jordan Taylor.
And we're both pathology residents who are just months shy of starting our forensic pathology fellowship.
So close. I'm so ready to be done with this.
Yeah, same.
And by this, we mean boards.
Yeah, for sure.
Which for me is in about 2.5 weeks.
That close?
Yes, for the AP side of it. And then a couple weeks later is the CP side of it.
Oof.
Too soon.
Too soon. And yet, not soon enough.
That's a good point. Yeah. But in order to celebrate us being close to the finish line, we're drinking some whiskey.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we would be drinking whiskey anyway.
That's true.
Yeah.
So we're going back to some of those whiskeys that were in that bro basket originally.
That we got so long ago.
We've just had those other really good whiskeys that we had to try in the meantime.
Yeah.
And so right now we're having the Knob Creek Kentucky Straight Bourbon Whiskey, which is one of the small batch 100 proof versions of Knob, which I generally really like, and this one is really good.
Extremely tasty.
We might have taken a sip before we started recording because we couldn't stop ourselves.
Yeah, it just smelled so good. Also, we ordered barbecue for this evening's meal, mm-hmm. So this will go great with that. Yeah.
It's very smoky, which is perfect for barbecue.
Yes, if there's any left by the time barbecue is.
Yes, but we have more whiskey. I'm not worried about that.
Yeah.
But today we're going to continue on the same vein as before. We're going to go through these questions. These are, I think, a little more broad. They don't really lump as much as the other one did. There's still some common topics, cause, manner, all that other good stuff that'll come up again. But it's kind of a good broad range. And then we're going to end with some postmortem chemistry. Because for some reason, there were no postmortem chemistry questions in this chapter. And that's something that is very boards relevant and will definitely be asked.
Yes. I feel like every time I do a practice thingy, there's
at least one.
One, yeah.
Yeah. So on the 8-hour long multiple question test day, we will get at least one, if not multiple of those.
Hopefully multiple, since I'm bothering to learn it.
That's true. Yes. And remember it, because this is actually one of the few things that we are studying that will be important
later on.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true.
The first one that we're going to cover, the broad category of this is genetic defects. It's essentially an x-ray of a fetus / infant with an obvious defect. Essentially, this kiddo only has one femur and is missing the other leg and maybe like a little bit of, your femur is the leg bone in your upper leg and then a little bit of your lower calf bone on the end, but not much. And essentially the question is like, does the mom have to worry about this happening in future kids? And this is kind of emphasizing the fact that there are so many congenital defects and a lot of congenital defects go to term. So the fetus develops and can, you know, makes it out. But there are also a lot of congenital defects that don't necessarily, honestly, the vast majority of congenital defects and things that happen lead to spontaneous abortions. And the layman's term for spontaneous abortion is miscarriage.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the things that this made me realize. Like, when people think of, like, oh, she had an abortion, a lot of people have had abortions, but they're just called spontaneous abortions and they're miscarriages.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, that's one of those words that people shouldn't use as easily as they do.
Abortion?
Yeah. As in, like, such a negative sense. It's like, oh, she had an abortion. It's like, a lot of women have had abortions. They're just spontaneous.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like, also abortions are fine. Not that, yeah.
Not to get political.
So this one was just out of left field, right? This one is a disease called sirenomelia, which essentially has a few associated congenital defects. And long story short, this is a sporadic thing that happened. It is not inherited from mom or dad, and this will not lead to further bad outcomes. I'm not going to go through all the details of it because realistically the specific congenital defect isn't going to come up on the boards, but
watch it come up.
I know,
on the boards.
Right now it's up on the boards. The crazy thing is this is called sirenomelia, and it's called that because it kind of looks mermaidish.
Yeah.
Because they only have one femur, so I thought that part was kind of cool. But I'm not going to go through all of the other little changes that happen within this. But this happens apparently 1 in 60,000 to 1 in 100,000 births, which is actually not that rare.
Yeah, that's a fair number.
Yeah, same rate as conjoined twins. So, you know, long story short, if mom decides to have another baby, there are no higher risk to have a baby with this defect than anybody else.
One of the things I liked about this question was one of the answers was counsel for sterilization of the father.
Yes, I saw that. Aggressive.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that you see and you're like, great, check that, cross that one off.
That is not the right answer, yeah.
Oh man, I love the ones that are just so obviously wrong that you just, like, you'll hear me laughing across the test room. And yeah.
Although some of the ones that are so obviously wrong, I'm like, it's so obviously wrong, is it right?
That's true.
And then I, like, get myself into a spiral of doubt. Yep. And
oh my god, so much shame. Doubtful spirals.
Yeah, yeah. Moving on. The next question,
I did not like this question.
I didn't either. It showed a picture of something that did not have to do with the cause of death.
Yes.
So my main takeaway from this question was, just because they show you a picture doesn't mean it has anything to do with how the person died.
Yes.
So in this case, the learning point is that when you get older, lots of changes happen in your body. One of those things is that your brain can atrophy. So this is shrinkage of the brain that occurs with age. And that puts elderly people at risk of subdural hemorrhage, which is bleeding that happens beneath the dura, which is one of those protective layers in your brain. And this happens due to tearing of these things called bridging veins. So when your brain shrinks, it has more room in the skull with which to move around. And so more room to move means more risk of tearing these bridging veins, which is why atrophy leads to increased risk of subdural hemorrhage.
Yep.
You know, overall, this is a fairly common finding in the elderly, and it may or may not be related to death.
And the actual finding is there are two subdural hemorrhages,
yep,
which are like these kind of thin crusts of clotted blood on the inside of the dura.
Yeah.
And they're kind of like peeling off a little bit at the bottom. I think they're trying to show that.
Oh, is that what they were trying to show? But it's on both sides.
I think that's what that is.
When I first looked at the picture without reading through the question, I was like, is this supposed to be like a meningioma or something?
I was thinking that, or is like a weird infection that's causing this like,
yeah,
like rind of weird red infectious material. Yeah. But yeah.
And a meningioma is a tumor that is arising from the dura itself. So yes, you can see that sometimes when you... It can be an incidental finding on autopsy.
And I think one of the other things this was trying to get at is elderly people can have these subdural hemorrhages, but because their brains are atrophied, there's more space for those subdural hemorrhages to sit.
Yeah.
So if one of us had a subdural hemorrhage like that, it would cause a mass effect and our brain would be squished.
Yes.
But because there's more space, they can sit in there and it's okay.
Yeah.
So it was definitely, the picture was misleading you, but I definitely saw it and was like, oh my god, subdural.
Yeah.
Patient definitely died of subdural.
Yeah.
If you read the question.
So yeah, it can be related to death in certain circumstances, but in this circumstance, because there was shrinkage, it's a non-space occupying lesion, so not pinching on the brain. Another thing that they might ask about on the test is like how old one of these is, and so the color can give that away. They didn't ask that in this question, but like, if it's a more yellowish, brownish color, it means that it's more chronic and so less likely to have contributed to an acute cause of death.
It was also, this one, I'm not going to say annoyed me, but it was weird in that the way that Lefkowitz is laid out is really good for learning. Like, they have all the questions and they go through all the answers at the end. And going through the answers in this one, they like only talked about the subdural and they didn't really talk about what this person actually died from, which was a pneumonia.
Yeah.
And so I was reading the question and trying to figure out why my answer was wrong, and they never actually explained why the correct answer was right. You know?
Yes.
Like, it was weird.
Yeah, because all of the answers that they had were possible causes of death. Like, yes, there wasn't enough information to determine which of those things actually killed the person, I thought.
No, I agree. And then I went with the subdurals because, you know,
that's they were the subdurals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Good stuff.
Yeah. This next one was luckily more straightforward. So they have a cut through a slice of brain, and there's this obvious wound track through the brain. That's kind of like this gaping wound tract, and it's asking what might have caused this. And a gaping wound track that kind of leaves a tract behind it like that is going to be a gunshot wound. It's going to be a big thing going through the brain. And the other options were all either small things or not something that would cause a wound like that. So there were incisions and stab wounds, and those would, you know, one, it's near impossible to stab through a skull with a knife. Like, it's not going to make it through the skull unless you're at, like, the petrous portion of the temple, of the temporal bone, which is, like, by your temple. Maybe you can create enough strength to get through that, but probably not. And then there was also infection, which infection could cause, like, cavity, but not an elongated cavity that's obviously, like, a wound trap. And then there was a skull fracture, which could cause, like, if you get a skull fracture, you could get lacerations or tearing in the brain, but you're not going to get this wound track left behind. So this was a little bit more straightforward, but this is what a gunshot wound to the brain looks like.
Yeah. The next one was one of those cause versus manner versus mechanism type questions. Yes. So remember to always read the question carefully and see if which one they're trying to get you to choose. I was actually tripped up by one of the practice questions recently where it was asking about mechanism, and I picked the cause because they so rarely ask about mechanism in the context of forensics that I was like, this is definitely asking about cause.
Yep.
Wrong. But in this case, it was, what is the manner of death depicted in this photograph? And it's just a slice of brain, and there's maybe a lesion.
No, that's a bullet.
Oh, is that what that is?
So the reason I got this wrong is because I didn't realize what that was.
Oh, I thought
that's
it was
a bullet.
Like, when I was first looking at it, it looks like a hematoma. Agreed. Or some sort of space occupying lesion.
I totally agree.
But I had no idea what exactly they were trying to show by this, like, one slice of brain. So I said undetermined, which is the right answer. Manner is the circumstances under which death occurred, as opposed to cause, which is the injury, disease, or combination of the two which led to the death.
Mm-hmm.
So manner, circumstances, cause, actual thing that caused the death.
Yep.
Mechanism, physiologic or biochemical process which leads to death.
Yeah.
Just want to throw those definitions out there as often as possible. Repetition, key. So manner, we have five different categories we can place things under: natural, homicide, suicide, accident, and undetermined. And undetermined is the category that you choose if you cannot choose another category after a thorough investigation. So the single picture, you can't tell any information from, so undetermined is the way it has to go.
Yeah, so when I read the answers to this one, it was, there's not enough information to explain how the projectile entered the brain in this case. And yeah. I was just like, what projectile? And I looked back and was like, oh, that's a bullet? But yeah.
Yeah.
So I definitely...
Definitely does not look like
I thought it was going for, like, it's cherry red, like carbon monoxide. Like, I couldn't tell what they were going for.
Yeah.
And end being a bullet. So I was like, well, I got that wrong.
Yep. Yeah. And you definitely can't tell from a single slice of brain without any other information whether this person shot themselves, suicide, whether somebody else shot the person, homicide. I don't think accident or natural would come up in the course of a projectile in the brain.
Well, you can accidental discharge. You're cleaning your gun and you accidentally shoot it.
Yeah, okay, true. Accident's not there then.
Natural, I think, is the one that you cannot have. I would agree with that.
Right, because if you had a heart attack while you were cleaning your gun and it went off, it would still be an accident?
Probably. I would probably call it an accident.
Yeah.
This is going to be one of those conversations that we're having constantly next year. It's going to be great. And by next year, I mean like a couple months.
Yes. July.
So soon. So this next question, I literally just wrote Coke with an exclamation point. So this is you have a picture of a woman with a nasal septum defect. So that's the thing in between your two nostrils. Essentially, there was a hole in there because she had done Coke, or as they said, chronic insufflation drug abuse. And essentially, Coke does two things. One, it's an anesthetic, so it takes away the pain. And two, it's a vasoconstrictor. So it constricts all your vessels down. So in your septum, in that thing in between your two nostrils, essentially you're constricting all your veins and you're not feeling it. So you're causing damage by inhaling these drugs, and you could essentially just deteriorate the lining between your two nostrils. And a finding like this on autopsy could suggest that this person takes drugs chronically through insufflation. And you can then, along with toxicology... correctly assume that they took Coke right before they died. And then this was asking about cause of death. So when you take Coke, it messes up a lot of things in your body, but essentially it can lead to dysrhythmias. And for this patient, it was a cardiac dysrhythmia secondary to acute cocaine intoxication.
And the way they highlighted this with the picture was putting the dowel through the perforated septum, so the hole in the septum. And when I first looked at the picture before reading the question, I thought it was a pencil. And I was like, is this one of those things where the kid is running with a pencil and stabs himself? No.
That's fair. No.
The next question has to do with patterns of injury, which is something we covered extensively in the last episode. And specifically, this is going into common findings with motor vehicle accidents. So the picture shows an aorta, which is that big central vessel that runs through your body that transports blood from the heart to the rest of your body. And it shows it and it's opened up. And then near the top, it looks like there's some sort of defect in it. And so they're asking what the lesion is classic for, so that defect or perforation in the aorta. And out of all the answers, motor vehicle collision is the correct choice.
Yep.
So your aorta is tethered by this fetal remnant called the ligamentum arteriosum. And so during rapid deceleration, so like if your car hits something, then your heart will continue to move forward even though the rest of your body stops, if it like hits the steering wheel or the front dashboard or whatever. And your heart continuing to move forward pulls at your aorta. And because it's tethered by this ligamentum arteriosum, it can tear at that point. And if the tearing or laceration is severe enough to transect or split the aorta open, it can cause rapid exsanguination, aka massive hemorrhage, leading to death. And so that's a common thing seen in motor vehicle accidents where there's this huge blunt force trauma to the chest.
Yeah, I did not realize that it tore at that point because that was where this fetal remnant was. That was something new. That was kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. I remember learning that when I was shadowing Dr. Omalu.
Oh, cool.
We got a motor vehicle accident and he was like, was right there. Oh, yeah. He was like, you know why this happens? I was like, heck if I know. I'm in high school still, dude.
I knew it was like attached to this, like, it was very well attached. Yeah. I didn't realize it was like this one point. That was cool.
Yeah.
Makes sense.
Anatomy, embryology, something, something.
Learn. Most people's least favorite part of med school.
Yeah.
The next one, I kind of wrote it up as, tumors can kill people too. So like a lot of what we do in, when we talk about forensics are, you know, accident, suicide, homicide, but there's a lot of natural things obviously that can kill you. And the biggest ones are heart disease. And for cancers, it's usually old people, but even in young people, if there's a tumor in a particularly bad spot, it can also do really bad things. So this was a teenager who, you know, has this history of this cardiac dysrhythmia, and she's been treated for it, and then she woke up dead one day. And
woke up dead.
On autopsy, they found that at her AV node, and the AV node is the one that conducts the electricity from your atria, which are the tiny sacs on top, into the ventricle, which are the big pumpy sacs on the bottom of your heart that pump blood to the rest of your body.
Your heart is just sacs.
It is four sacs that just pump. And if you have something at this node, essentially, hearts are really cool, but all of the electricity goes around the atria and kind of goes through this node before it goes back out all the way around to your ventricles. So if you have something blocking this conduction system, you could have something that's called complete heart block. So, you know, the electric impulses are completely blocked from going through your heart. And essentially she had this particular tumor that was sitting right at this node. This particular one is a cystic tumor of the AV node. Not particularly great name, but
straight to the point.
Straight to the point. And the question went into a lot of things about the origin of this tumor. This particular one isn't genetic. It's a remnant, essentially, when in embryology, when things move around to different places, sometimes they don't end up at the place that they're supposed to, or they leave something behind.
Like the ligamentum arteriosum.
And if it's left...
Sounds like a Harry Potter spell.
It probably is a Harry Potter spell. And that's where we get the name from, because the wizards left it behind for us.
Oh my gosh! Mm-hmm.
And so this person had this little remnant, which they think is... when the AV node migrates, they think it's like a remnant that gets left behind on this migration path. And it's sitting at this point that led to this, you know, complete heart block. So she died from a tumor. And as a forensic pathologist, we still need to be able to look under the microscope and identify these tumors, because while a lot of people are diagnosed with cancer before they die, a lot of people die suddenly with their cancers that are the cause of death, but they weren't necessarily known by doctors or brought to medical attention beforehand. We are still pathologists.
Say what? It is in the name. Forensic pathologist. Yeah. The next question was one that I thought was poorly worded.
Agreed.
Yeah. This one was asking about what information is pertinent over the course of a death investigation.
Yes.
But in like a very poor way, because yes, all of the information would be pertinent, I yes, feel like, to some degree. Because
even the one, the right answer, I yeah, feel like it's not going to hurt to know. Right. You know, like, why wouldn't you ask?
Well, and also, I think, like, the investigators would get that information because a lawyer on the stand would ask you, like, is it possible that...
We should go into what they're calling.
Yes, yeah. Sorry.
No, I totally agree, but they're going to confuse everybody that yes, doesn't know what we're talking
about. So this is a picture of a skull with a gunshot wound and a dowel showing the trajectory of the gunshot. And so it's saying that this is an apparent self-inflicted wound. What are the pertinent questions that you would want to ask over the course of the investigation, which all of them are pertinent,
yes,
I think. The actual meat that this question is getting to is which of the following would be pertinent for establishing intent or ability to perform a self-inflicted gunshot wound.
Yes.
So that would have been a better way to word the question.
Yeah.
Because one of the things is, was he right-handed or left-handed? And that has nothing to do with intent or ability.
And it doesn't help with... Yeah, I think you're going to get into it. Like, I feel like the biggest thing is, like, it doesn't help with knowing where the gun was coming from. Like, it, like, I think the point of it is it suicide or homicide? And if they're right-handed but it comes from the left side, it doesn't mean it couldn't be him.
Right. I think it would come up because, like, there are certain trajectories that are more awkward depending on yes, what handed you are.
Yes.
So they would ask it yes, over the course of the investigation, and I think it would have some bearing
yes,
on what they say. But, like, that... That doesn't, handedness doesn't help with whether or not he had the ability to yeah, commit suicide, or whether he was intent, like had motive to commit suicide. All the rest of the things they asked have to do with intent or ability.
It's also part of it is like, realistically, this is going to come up for us when there's a homicide and somebody's like, well, he's right-handed and the shot was from the, you know, right side to the left side, or vice versa, left side to the right side. Does this mean that he can't have committed suicide? And the answer is no. Like, yes, it just has no bearing, essentially. Because just because you're right-handed doesn't mean that I'm not going to want to hold the gun in my left hand for some other reason. Like, you don't know what's going on.
Yeah. But it would come up during the investigation.
Yeah,
and
agreed,
it would be considered pertinent
totally
information.
Yeah.
Just maybe not for determining that this was a suicide.
Yes.
Which... That should have been the question, is like, what information is not needed to determine that this was a suicide?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And they made the good point that, like, you know, it doesn't take much to pull a trigger. You don't need your dominant forefinger to pull a trigger.
Yeah.
You can do it with your toe, which for shotgun shots, when somebody does suicide with a shotgun, often, like, they have the bottom down and they yeah, use their toe to pull the trigger. Like, you definitely don't need your dominant forefinger, right?
Yeah. Them. But poorly worded question.
Yes, totally agreed. The next one is a little more straightforward. Essentially, they give you all the information in the prompt and you don't even really need to see the picture. It's the picture is accompanying this question is a brain with air spaces going through the vasculature.
It's a CT of a brain.
Yes, thank
so
you.
It's more a CT like of a brain. Radiology.
Yes. And you have the information that it's a scuba diver who had an incident and he ascended very quickly. And if you know anything about scuba diving, after you've been down for a while and you want to come back up, you need to, you know, kind of stop every so often and let the gases in your blood re-equilibrate to the new pressure that you're at. Because if you rise too quickly, all the gas is going to degas from your blood and cause bubbles. And those bubbles can go places and cause bad things. And the main thing is, you know, you have this rapid expansion of your air in your lungs. And then that will lead to the lung parenchyma and your alveoli rupturing. That air can then go into your capillaries, which will then go through your vasculature and either go into your coronary, which is your heart arteries, or your cerebral, which is your brain arteries, and it can cause emboli there. So essentially you have these big bubbles of gas that go and stop the blood flow to where it needs to go. And for this person, they had these air bubbles that went up all the way through their brain vasculature, and they died. The other thing that this notes is your stomach can get really quickly inflated and lead to mucosal tearing or rupture of your stomach, which, as in our eating too much episode, mm-hmm. we talked about how rupturing your stomach can lead to a lot of bad issues. So this one, mainly you didn't really need the picture, but it didn't hurt. And this person died from what's called extra alveolar air syndrome because the air goes to bad places.
That was a name that I'd not heard before for this.
Same.
I was like, you mean the bends? Mm-hmm. Which one of these is the bends?
Yep.
I just did process of elimination.
Yep.
The next question shows a microscopic image of lung tissue that is abnormal in that the alveoli, which are those tiny balloons / air sacs at the end of your airway tree, are filled with this pink acellular material, which is abnormal. They should be filled with air.
Because, which is clear, and you do not see anything on imaging.
Yes, because that is what the lungs are for. They are to facilitate the exchange of oxygen and carbon dioxide in your body. So fluid in the lungs, not conducive to oxygen exchange. And so this is basically asking, what is this characteristic for? Like, what entity does this represent? Mm-hmm. And the answer is that this finding, which is called pulmonary edema, so fluid in the lungs, is not specific for any specific disease or injury. It can have a wide variety of causes, including heart failure, drowning, blah, 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 anything that puts fluid into your lungs.
Yep. The other thing I found interesting about this one was if there's a long period between the injury or the insult that led to death and death itself, like if the person's down for a while, they can also have this. So it's not even necessarily associated with disease processes, but if they've just been down for a while before they actually die, you can also have it. So it's just really common.
The answer is always post-mortem artifact.
Yes, exactly. This next one highlights that we do still need to know some things about brains in forensic pathology.
Say what?
And one of the most common things we need to know things about is dementia or changes either as you get older or have various genetic predispositions. And this imaging shows a histologic image of some neurons with what are called neuritic plaques. So essentially slightly more dense eosinophilic, which just means red-pink material in the cytoplasm. So you see these quote-unquote neuritic plaques, and they point towards dementia. They're seen in a lot of different types of dementia, so you can't say it's Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease or something like that. But this patient has dementia, which means that they might be forgetful. The other thing to note is these can be seen in patients without any clinical signs of dementia. So it's one of those things you can be like, hey, death investigators should ask about it, but just because you have these could just be because you're old. You might not have dementia yet. But this goes into, you know, this is an older person who is found dead in her bed at the other end of the house around, you know, and maybe a gas stove was left on. And so essentially this is saying, you know, make sure that you look at the whole scene because she might have dementia and she might have left the stove on. The other important thing of this to think about is patients with dementia can be targets of abuse. So if you see this in an autopsy, even if something looked totally normal, you might want to go back and make sure that this older person died from actually natural causes and not from being neglected or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're back from a quick break that we ate some barbecue, finished the one whiskey, and we just started some Woodford Reserve.
Which is also super tasty.
It's a little less smoky and a little more like whiskey.
You have a way with words.
Yep, that's why we have a podcast, because I have a way with words.
You asked for that one.
Wait, I did. We should both be fired.
Agreed. Yeah. So the next question. I guess I'm the queen of motor vehicle accidents.
Yeah, you got all of these.
But This one is showing a picture of an imprint that some embroidery from clothing has left on somebody's skin, a decedent's skin. So essentially it's asking, like, this person had enough blunt force trauma that their clothing made an imprint on them. So what are some possible injuries associated with chest impacts that are, you know, hard enough to cause this sort of imprinting? And out of all of the answers, the only one that doesn't have to do with blunt force trauma to the chest is dicing. And I talked about this last episode.
Yes.
As a means of determining where people are sitting in a car, mm-hmm. When you're doing the autopsy. But dicing are these little cuts that you can see that are due to tempered glass from side window shattering.
Going psh, psh.
And it's made that way so that you don't get these bigger cuts. Bigger cuts that can lead to massive hemorrhage. It's the window breaks in this way to prevent that. And in standard U.S. cars, drivers will have them on the left side of their body and passengers will have them on the right. And they are variably described as abrasions or incisions. But as I said last time, glass is sharp. So I think that they are more incisions than abrasions. And they have nothing to do with blunt force trauma to the chest.
Nope.
It just has to do with the car being impacted enough that the window shattered.
Yeah. Yep. And it's definitely one of those things. It's just like you have to read the question because it's like, what is associated with this chest impact?
Yes.
So it's like, okay, well.
Dicing didn't have anything to do with the chest itself.
Exactly. Next one is more cause versus manner. This is a dude who's found dead with a syringe in his arm and drugs on board. So we know. So from all of this, they're implying that this person had suicide due to drug overdose. But it's asking for cause. So suicide is the manner. Drug overdose is the cause. And they list various things, two of which being accident and natural, which, as Nicole has gone into, are manners. So those are automatically ruled out because it's asking for cause. And then it leads, then the last things are cardiopulmonary arrest, asphyxia, and acute opioid intoxication. Now, asphyxia and acute opioid intoxication are causes of death. And in this case, we knew he had a syringe in his arm and drugs on board, so he died from acute opioid intoxication.
They even say it's morphine, which is an opiate.
Oh, yeah, sorry. But the other thing I wanted to note in this is one of the things was cardiopulmonary arrest. And in the end, everybody dies of cardiopulmonary arrest, but this isn't what's called the proximal cause. The opioid intoxication led to cardiopulmonary arrest, but that's not the cause. That's not what caused him to lead to the cardiopulmonary arrest. It was the acute opioid intoxication. So that's was the point I wanted to make from this. Everybody eventually dies from not getting enough oxygen to your heart or your brain.
Yeah.
But that's not what cause is.
And this is a common mistake that people put on death certificates.
Exactly.
Like, a lot of people who are not trained in filling out death certificates are like, well, of course they died of cardiopulmonary arrest. And like, and it's
due to what? Due to electrolyte imbalance. Due to what? Due to renal failure. Yeah, that's it. That's the renal failure.
Yeah.
And they kind of like, you know, they think too granular and it's like, what is the big thing that caused this person to die?
Yeah.
They got hit by a truck. They had an overdose. Big picture is cause of death, not the little thing.
If anything, cardiopulmonary arrest is a mechanism, but mm-hmm. even then, it's like, it's not a specific mechanism.
Yep,
it's exactly. just the definition of death.
Yes, exactly.
or
exactly.
one of the definitions
yes.
of death. Since we also have brain death.
Yes. Brains.
Brains. They're very important.
They are.
Yeah. So the next question was asking, which of the following is not a typical thermal artifact? And we talked about this in one of our episodes where we talked about death
Pompeii.
With fires.
This is Pompeii.
Was it Pompeii?
Yeah. Natural fire deaths.
Natural fire deaths. So lots of different things can happen when a person dies and then is in a fire or dies because of a fire. But some of the common things are what we call a pugilistic posture.
Yes.
This happens because the heat causes muscles to contract. And so you get this, like, I don't know how to describe it. I should have looked this up, but it's
essentially
like,
there's a lot of heat and it sucks all the moisture out. So your muscles contract.
Yeah.
And one of the
things is your arms kind of look like you're in a boxing stance.
Yeah. And they say, like, because all of your muscles are contracting, you'd be like, well, why aren't your arms straight? Because you have muscles that pull your arms straight. Well, the flexors, which is
in this case, biceps, are stronger than extensors. So same with the legs. Like, the ones that bend your leg are stronger than the ones that straighten your leg. So your body just kind of curls up, which is what a pugilistic posture is. Yeah. Because the flexors are stronger than your extensors.
Most of the time. If you want to be unique, you should work out...
only triceps.
Only
the
triceps.
The tiniest biceps and just the hugest triceps.
Tricep day.
Oh my God, can you imagine?
And hamstring day?
And
hamstring day. Other things are weight loss and corneal clouding, and the heat causes, like, water evaporation, so you have all this loss of water, which leads to those two things. And then the last two things were different types of brain bleeds. So one of the things we talked about were epidural hematomas. So as opposed to what I talked about earlier with the subdural, that's below the dura. Epidural means above the dura, so between the skull and the dura.
Did you read why fire leads to epidurals versus subdurals? Because I thought about it, and then I forgot to look it up.
I kind of looked it up. I found this one paper. It was actually a radiology paper, and it was talking about them. They're also known as heat hematomas.
Okay.
So they said that they're caused by the dura mater contracting, and then it peels away from the skull.
Oh.
And when it peels away from the skull, then that can burst some of the vessels there, and that leads to exudation. So the blood flowing out of the vessels and into that space that is caused by the peeling away.
Well, that makes sense. And it helps when you know the mechanism sometimes to remember it.
For sure. Yeah. And then they mentioned that the heat causes the blood to coagulate.
Yes.
So to clot. And then that makes the epidural hematoma. So it's not actual bleeding. It's like, it's, you know, a thermal artifact.
Yes.
Due to all of the heat. Subdural hematomas are not seen, and I don't have a good way of remembering that other than to just memorize that epidural is fire, subdural, not fire.
Yeah. But no, I think it helps that we know the mechanism that, like, fire causes heat, which causes things to shrink, which leads to blood on the outside.
Yeah.
So that's really helpful for me. So next one is more electrocution, so a different kind of burn. So what this question wants you to take away is high voltage electrocution, so more than 1,000 volts, as we went on in our episode on electrocutions, usually do leave burns behind. They can also cause other kinds of massive damage, like clothing that will explode away from your body, branding from various things that might be near you. But high voltage, you will have burns. But with low voltage, less than half of them leave burns behind. So this is where it's really important to investigate a scene, and this is one of the many reasons why workplace deaths are investigated. Because if we remember, with low voltage, you can be conscious for 10 to 15 seconds after you have this electrocution. So you might talk, you might walk, you might try to do something. You'll move away from where you are, and if, you know, you're found however far away from the electric socket that caused this injury, it might not be the most apparent because you won't necessarily have a burn left behind. So this was one of those, like, all the things are true except in, like, all electrocutions leave burns, which low voltage do not. High voltage, 99% of the time will. They also talk about how lightning strikes cause that furning, and they kind of make it sound more common in this. But if we remember from our episode, furning isn't actually that common, even with lightning strikes, which are rare to begin with. You don't always see furning. So you might... But think about it, and ferning is not marbling, which is one of the postmortem changes where you know, in the distribution of your blood vessels, some bacteria start to activate and you get this weird pattern left behind on the skin.
Yeah, and I know at least I have been very bad about posting to social media, so I'm making notes right now of things to post, and it's kind of an extensive list, but I'll get to it eventually.
Yeah, let me know and I will post to mine too. I'm also really bad right now. We apologize. Boards is just eating our lives, so we're sorry.
Plus, I'm still on a rotation that is taking a lot more mental energy than I had hoped it would.
Yep, same.
Anyway.
Almost done.
Almost
there.
Yes.
A couple more weeks.
Light at the end of the tunnel, in a good way, not a train.
I wasn't expecting that.
The next one is about postmortem change, which we've talked about extensively, but this one has to do with estimating time of death based on postmortem changes. Mm-hmm. And as we've also talked about extensively, unlike on TV shows, a lot of these postmortem changes are better for determining where the body was positioned versus giving a time of death, but they can provide rough estimates if the environment, body habitus, etc., is conducive to using these timelines.
And we're close enough to death. Like, the further away you get, the worse we are at this.
At estimating time, yeah. Yeah. So, algor mortis is, it's called cooling, postmortem cooling, but actually the body temp changes to match the environment.
Yes.
When a body is cooling to match the environment, this typically means that it decreases by 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit per hour. And then there's liver mortis, which is the pooling of the blood in the dependent areas of the body. So those areas of the body that are closer to the ground. And it's a reddish purple discoloration, but it can be different depending on the cause of death. Like yes. In carbon monoxide, it's this cherry red.
Yes.
For the first 0.5 to 2 hours, it's blanching. So if you press on it, it'll turn, like the decedent's underlying skin color will be more visible. And then by 12 to 18 hours, it's fixed. So if you push on it, it's just going to stay the same color.
Interesting. I think that this is also one of those things that, like, depending on the source you read, is going to be different.
Yeah.
Like, the one that I saw was, like, 30 minutes to 4 hours is when it starts, and then it's set by 12. So what I read that as, like, from 30 minutes to about 4 hours, you might have nothing, and you might start to have it.
Yeah.
And then anywhere from that time up to about 12 hours, it might be blanching. And then after 12 hours, it's pretty set.
Yep.
So it's kind of, everybody has
all estimates.
Yeah.
And then the last big postmortem change is rigor mortis. And this is the muscle stiffening that happens after death. And it's due to loss of this thing called ATP, which helps your muscles relax while you're alive. But obviously when you die, your body's not producing this thing anymore. So your muscles are not able to relax.
Yes.
And it begins in your smaller muscles, usually within 2 to 4 hours, and then is fully developed in 6 to 12 hours. But then it starts to diminish by 24 to 48 hours. So depending on a bunch of different factors. That means that when rigor mortis is like a variable degree, that could mean that it's either coming or going.
Yes.
And a way to determine whether it's coming or going is looking at the corneas. Yes. So your eyes, if they're clouding, that can tell you that the person's been dead for longer. And so the rigor is likely diminishing because it's going away. So it's been longer than that 24 to 48 hour period.
The corneas are really clouded closer to 24 hours. So
yep.
It's a kind of nice time point around. These are all plus minus a good number of hours.
Yeah. But actually, if you want to determine a good estimate for time of death or like range, the best thing is the environment. So yes. Like looking to see if the decedent has unpaid bills or like eyewitnesses the last time they were seen alive. Those are actually the best estimates for time
or
of death.
That's for longer term though. Like unpaid bills, that's more in like the days to weeks, right? If they've been dead for like 12 hours, that's not going to help you determine time of death.
No.
I think of those as more the long-term ones, but yeah. So this next one is actually very well related to the prior one. This one is talking about what will affect the rate of decomposition. Because when you're looking at all of the things that Nicole just mentioned, there's a lot of things that can change them. So as Nicole talked about with algor mortis, the ambient temperature will change it. The body habitus, if there are heavier, it will take them longer for their body weight to change. If they're wearing clothing, it'll take longer. If like, think about it, if they're wearing like a big parka and like winter clothing, they're going to stay their same temperature for much longer than they would if they're naked.
Ooh.
If they're poo bearing.
Poo bearing?
Have you not heard of that? Like,
no.
Would it, like Pooh Bear only wears a t-shirt?
Yeah.
And so like you find a lot of decedents without pants on with just t-shirts. So they often say, like, they're poo-bearing.
Oh my gosh. That is my new favorite thing. I love it.
It's amazing the amount of people that are just at home, apparently, in t-shirts and no pants.
Is that so what our life is going to be like next year?
That's what our life is going to be that.
I do not like
well, not like at our home, but,
okay.
Like, I went
oh,
in.
Okay.
No,
I was gonna say.
No, I mean,
for... You walk around naked? This is a thing I didn't know.
For our decedents that we will be interacting with, that will be our life.
Got another Pooh Bear over here.
But really. Oh, man.
Or Donald Duck. So many characters.
Or Donald Duck, that's true. Yeah, Donald Duck's another good one.
I was just listening to a podcast that talked about Donald Duck. I think that's
how we never wore pants.
Yeah.
That was pretty good. So, getting back to factors that change your rate of postmortem change, one of the things is rate of decomposition or putrefaction. So that's the kind of later slash endpoint of our postmortem changes. And again, this can, a lot of things, cause of death, body size, ambient temperature, medical health. And I think this is really important because when you think about cause of death, if somebody died of sepsis, they already have more bacteria in their blood than they would otherwise. So they're going to decompose faster because they already have a head start.
Yeah. And they probably had a higher temperature to begin
exactly,
with too.
Exactly. Yeah. And the fun fact from this one is sepsis is a Greek word for putrefaction.
Oh, really?
Did you know that?
I did not know that.
So, you know, sepsis has a head start on this because there's already bacteria there, right? So sepsis is a word for decomp. Right? Oh. If you think about it, like, it's just your body is fighting the bacteria from decomposing you.
Wow. That's
a different
so
way to think about it, right?
So, like, everybody in the ICU is decomposing?
That's true. Their body's fighting back. Is the, are the bacteria, or are you going to win?
Yeah.
And then the point of this question was that the amount of alcohol in your blood does not change it. Alcohol, no matter how much you have, is not going to preserve you at all, so it won't make
is
you decompose
true?
Slower.
Is
according
that
to this question, we can test. No, we can't.
That sounds like an inhumane experiment if
inhumane
I've ever
experiment.
Heard one.
But, you know.
Drink this entire bottle of Everclear, and then I'm going to kill you.
Oh, man. No, thank you. I would stop with the...
No? Bad memories?
Nope. Yeah, Everclear was a bad one in college. But yeah, so...
But it looks just like water.
Oh, it does not taste like water.
It smells like paint remover.
It does smell like paint remover. Long story short, concentration of blood alcohol. Yes, that's really the only thing I want you to take from this question. As we're drinking whiskey.
More taste than Everclear.
Cheers. Oh, man.
The next question was asking about drowning. So this came up in last month's episode as well. Drowning is a diagnosis of exclusion.
Yes.
One of the few, many that we have in forensic pathology.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain clues that you can look for. So pulmonary edema, fluid in the lungs, sphenoid sinus fluid, which is the thing I talked about in last month's episode, where you can get fluid from one of the nasal passages up in the head. You can also look for debris under the decedent's nails or in their teeth or in their GI tract because they're, like, swallowing some of the water when they're trying to breathe.
Yes.
Or if they're, like, clawing at whatever shoreline there is, things like that. And then, of course, eyewitness statements can tell you that the person was still alive when they were in the water.
Yes.
And then foam cones you can see coming out of the mouth as well. So lots of clues, but nothing that is definitive or
yes.
diagnostic for drowning. Another thing that they talked about in this question stem were washerwoman hands.
Yeah.
So like when you sit in a body of water for too long and your hands get all pruney, that's what they're
yeah.
referring to. And that is just a sign of submersion, not
yeah.
of drowning, obviously, because it happens in live people as well, as probably everybody listening to this has seen on themselves.
I just love that they use the term washerwoman skin changes. Like, it's such a bad term, like, in so many ways.
It's just also so antiquated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. No, that's what I mean. Like,
but I
it's
guess
a,
that's, like, lots of medicine.
That's
the
fair.
Names are still stuck
yeah.
in the past.
Oh, you don't remember what this disease is? Because it was named after some random dude 50-100 years ago?
And then
so
by the time
you
finally memorize it, they're changing it because the dude was a Nazi?
Yes. Everybody in the past did something bad.
Yeah. I mean, everybody in the present has done something
That's
bad.
Also true.
People are...
horrible.
Well, I was going to say people are flawed, but,
oh,
you know.
People are also... That's probably better.
I guess I'm a bit more of an optimist than you, which is something I never thought I would say of myself.
You've never met me. No, just kidding.
What? I've met Definitely you on numerous me. Occasions. There is recorded evidence of the fact that I have met you before.
JK, JK, JK.
But not that JK because she's been canceled.
Well, because she did something bad.
Exactly. Because she's a flawed human being.
She is a flawed human being.
Like the rest of us.
It's true.
Although,
oh, man.
Hopefully most of us are not flawed to that degree.
Yeah, that's true. Whew. Okay. So next one is talking about manual strangulation. And you really, the only thing you need from the question stem is this is manual strangulation. So what could that be? And manual strangulation, as we've talked about before, is when somebody is using their hands to strangle somebody's neck and cut off blood and or airflow to various places. And the correct answer for this one was it's never suicidal. And we talked about this one because if you are trying to self-manual strangle, you will pass out at some point and your hands will let go and you will get blood flow back and you will start breathing again. So that is the one always things. Like there, one of the things you learn when you're taking any kind of test is it's never and never always, right?
Yeah.
It's never and ever and it's never and always. This is the one time that it actually is a never. Everything else is there's also like another, it's always accompanied by petechia and a fractured hyoid. Petechiae are pretty common, but a fractured hyoid is pretty rare. That's more in like judicial hangings with a drop from height. So one of the other things it says it's rarely seen along with sexual assault, but breath play is a thing. Might not be your thing, but it's a thing. And it's something that you need to think about. So that definitely could be a cause of manual strangulation in association with a sexual assault, or not even necessarily sexual assault, but just sex. And then there's also some other terms, which it's also known as burking. And if you remember from one of our prior episodes, burking is when somebody's kneeling on your chest and smothering you with a pillow at the same time. And so manual strangulation is hands on neck, which is not that. And then the last one was, it's also known as smothering, which as I just said is pillow on face, which is not hands on neck. So it's kind of like some of them are a definitions thing.
Y'all are really missing out on the hand gestures again this episode. Every time Jordan says manual strangulation, hands on neck, hands out in a grasping claw motion.
You love it.
I do love it. It's also terrifying.
It's true. One other thing that I want to mention again is compression of the vasculature takes way less force. That's my cat, her vasculature is not being compressed. And compression of vasculature takes much less force than the compression of trachea. Like, it takes a lot to cut off that noise, if you guys can hear her yelling in the background.
Not that we would try.
No, I love her so much. She gets away with murder.
Murder.
Meow.
Meowder.
Now she's looking at me. But hands on neck, vasculature gets cut off before breath tube. That's just for you.
Breathing tube. Oh, so fun. I hope when I watch you testify in court, you continue with the hand gestures.
I don't think I could stop myself.
I wonder if the recommendation will be for you to sit on your hands to probably prevent yourself from doing it. But I feel like it helps with explanations. Well,
definitely for me it does.
Yeah. Anyway. The next question is asking about alcohol.
Our favorite topic.
Currently imbibing. And so it's just like a bunch of random facts about alcohol metabolism and where it's absorbed and all of these things.
Definitions.
So I think one of the important takeaways from this is that you can calculate blood alcohol level with a formula. It's called the Widmark formula. And it is blood alcohol concentration equals the percentage of the alcohol times the ounces of alcohol imbibed times this constant, 5.14, divided by the weight of the person times a gender constant, which is 0.55 for women and 0.63 for men, I believe.
Okay.
And then that subtract 0.015 times hours.
I will not remember that for the boards.
Right. I have a flashcard, which is why I had it memorized, because it did come up on one of my practice questions. But essentially, part one of the formula is determining the number of standard drinks and converting that to grams of ethanol. Part two of the equation, that weight times a gender constant, is taking into account body weight and gender, because those do have an impact on how fast you metabolize alcohol. Part three takes into account the alcohol leaving your system. So alcohol goes away at about 0.015 grams per deciliter per hour. So that's how that formula works.
I think the easier way for anybody that's actually using this to study for boards is a standard human, which we have decided is a 70 kilogram man, for one drink, which is defined as, you know, an ounce of hard liquor, 4 ounces of wine, 12 ounces of beer, raises your blood alcohol level by 0.02 grams per deciliter. And then it's metabolized at 0.015 grams per deciliter. So, like, it's metabolized a little bit less than what it raises your blood alcohol level. And the way I think about it is the legal limit is 0.08. And so one drink will get you a quarter of the way there.
If you're a 70-kilogram man.
Which, honestly, you can... In my mind, the way I approach a lot of things with boards is... No matter what the weight is, if I assume it's a 70-kilogram man, my calculations aren't going to be that far off, right? And whatever I calculate from that is going to be close enough to one of the answers. And it's probably not going to, they're probably not going to have things that are like fractions of decimals off from one another. So,
yeah, the one practice question I had, I don't know if it was a 70-kilogram man. I feel like it wasn't. They like... And it was pretty close, all of the answers. But, like, one question on the test isn't going to hurt you.
And memorizing, for me, memorizing a formula like this for one question on a test is not going to.
Yeah. I mostly wanted to memorize it just so.
That's fair.
In my own mind, if I'm drinking, I can kind of convert it really quick and see what my approximate blood alcohol concentration is. And, remember, that's a standard drink. And a standard drink is not, like, my favorite typical, like, Belgian beer 10 ounces. That is not a standard drink. No.
And also, for some reason, I thought, like, when you get a drink in, like, a shot glass, that's 1.5 ounces, but a standard drink is only 1 ounce. So, like,
explanation, it said 1 ounce of a 100 proof.
Oh, is that what it was? Yeah. Oh, so it's 1.5 of an 80 proof?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then it said 4 ounces of wine, but...
It's 5, right?
It's 5 ounces, okay. But that's if the alcohol concentration is about 12%, which I feel like most wines are 14 to 15.
Gotcha.
So okay. It would be more like 4 ounces. And then 12 ounces of a regular beer, which is 5%, which a lot of the, like, craft brews are definitely way above 5%. Oh, yeah. 100%. And then bacteria produce alcohol when they are decomposing your body. Yes. So you have to make sure that your fluids are consistent. So if you take vitreous and blood, and the blood has alcohol, but the vitreous doesn't, and the vitreous is that fluid in your eyeball that's relatively sequestered from the rest of your body. So if you're not finding alcohol there, but you're finding it in the blood, it's probably decomposition, especially if it's like a minimal amount, because bacteria don't produce that much.
No. Well, eventually they will.
Eventually.
It depends on how far you are. I think that's also one of the things, like, if they're found down and you get them, like, and you're doing the autopsy the day after they die, it's not going to be that different.
Yeah.
But if you find them a week later, it's going to be pretty different. So it kind of, it's hard sometimes to think of, like, how far out you're actually autopsying these people.
Yeah. But safe to say, if you find it in the vitreous and the blood, it's probably not due to bacteria.
Yes. So you get all of the motor vehicle accidents, and I get all of the brain ones. Because I somehow have had to explain all of the brain things.
That happened last episode, too.
No, I know. Which is good for my learning, but... So this next one is talking about this thing called diffuse axonal injury. And essentially what this is whiplash. So you're in a car, stop suddenly, your brain slams forward or your head flies backwards, and you get this rapid acceleration, deceleration, rotational force. And essentially in your brain, it can actually tear your axons, which are the processes and neurons that send signals from your brain to wherever they end up in your body. So there are certain areas in particular in your brain that are more susceptible to this kind of injury, and it kind of makes sense. So one of them is a corpus callosum, which is the thing that connects the two halves of your brain. So if your brain is being jostled around back and tear, that makes sense. What's called the paraventricular areas, so your ventricles are the fluid-filled kind of sacs in your brain. And again, that's kind of where things can move a little bit more, so I think of that as an area. And then this particular area in your brainstem called the rostral pons, which something you just have to remember, but you can imagine your brainstem is kind of like where a lot of things are moving around slash kind of anchored. Mm. So that could be a little more susceptible to this kind of injury. As we said in the last episode, when you're looking at it under the microscope and throwing different immunohistochemical stains, so different chemicals that will stain different proteins, to look for diffuse axonal injury, you're going to use beta amyloid precursor protein, or BAP, is one of the things that's going to mark diffuse axonal injury because those axons are broken and that protein is coming out. Now, with diffuse axonal injury, you may have no gross findings, or you could have this triad of findings, which include retinal hemorrhages. So your retina is the thing in the back of your eye, so there's little bleeds in that. Small subdural hemorrhages, which kind of makes sense. The dura is what attaches, so you can get some tearing on those attachment points, and then subarachnoid hemorrhages. So the vessels under there with a strong enough force can start to tear. And the other thing with diffuse axonal injury, besides like for adults, a car crash, is unfortunately when you think of babies and shaken baby syndrome. So when you have a small human that is shaken very hard, their head...
I think you mean a sub-adult?
A sub-adult. When you have a tiny sub-adult, then their head will kind of whip forward and backwards. We don't have... Sorry, my cat has decided to play with all of her paper at this moment because it is time to be awake. When their head gets thrown backward and forward, you get this acceleration, deceleration, rotational force on your brain. And you can lead to these things. And retinal hemorrhages are kind of one of the pathognomonic things with shaken baby syndrome.
Although you can see them in other things.
Yes. Agreed.
Speaking of dead babies. Oh, that was a terrible segue. The next question.
Trigger warning?
I should have said that earlier, I guess. Because we did talk about suicide already.
Our entire podcast is trigger
warning. Yeah. So sudden infant death syndrome was the topic of the next question. And if you want to know all about that, you should listen to our episode with special guest Dr. Michael Moulton, where we talk about sudden unexpected death in infants and children. But SIDS, as it's known, is the sudden unexpected death of an infant less than a year old that remains unexplained after a thorough investigation, including a complete autopsy. And that's because many causes of death may have no autopsy findings. So you need to have that thorough investigation of the scene, the clinical history, maybe sending out for genetic testing for like cardiac abnormalities that are not grossly visible, etc., to rule out any other causes of death before you can make that diagnosis, I say in quotes, of SIDS, because it's a diagnosis of exclusion.
Yes. What I also, I feel like I knew this, but I forgot it, is SIDS is a death of an infant less than 1 year old, but it really is rare to happen after the first 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So if think of SIDS, think of like 6 months and younger.
Yeah.
So the next question was one of those, do you know this particular term and what it means? So they're talking about commotio cordis, which is often thought of when somebody gets hit with like a baseball in the chest, takes a punch to the chest. Essentially, there is you have a sharp, blunt force that hits the chest during a very specific part of the cardiac cycle. Do you know what they, did you read the question answers for this one or no?
I didn't.
Okay, good. Do you know what they did to figure out how and why this happens?
Oh, I have no idea. Was it an animal study?
It was.
Was it monkeys?
No.
Was it pigs?
Yes.
Pigs are very similar to humans, which is why I guess them next.
So they tested baby pigs.
Oh, boo.
Which I'm just picturing all the tiny little micro pigs. Just so, yeah. So essentially they had blunt force to piggy chest.
Yeah.
And they found that it's during a very specific part of the cardiac cycle, 15 milliseconds before the peak of the T wave, which is when your heart is kind of resetting itself.
Yeah.
If you get hit during this like really teeny tiny window, you'll go into VFib, which is ventricular fibrillation, which is when your heart sacs are just kind of randomly gesticulating all over the place.
I just love breathing tip and heart sacs. It's just my favorite.
I'm glad to keep you entertained. That's really all that matters. So yeah, commotio cordis, sudden blunt impact on the chest during the right part of the cardiac cycle leads to ventricular fibrillation and death.
Yeah, I didn't read the answer to this one because I knew it already.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
I only read it because sometimes there's random fun facts like baby pigs or sad fun facts like baby pigs.
Yeah. It's interesting that they chose baby pigs.
Yeah, I don't... Maybe they're smaller and it's easier to, like,
punch get them?
No. No, as in, like, so bigger people with EKGs, it's harder to tell what's going on. Yeah. But if you're smaller, you can get a better signal.
It just seems like...
Because they're smaller, they can get the electrical signal better.
Yeah, it just seems like an adult pig would be more similar to...
Well, maybe you human. Don't have to feed it for as long, so it's cheaper.
Well, but then you get more bacon when it dies.
That's true. I don't think you're allowed to eat these test animals.
You're not?
I don't
think
they do.
That seems like such a waste.
I don't disagree, but...
It's not like they were well, maybe they were injecting them with something, but
I don't know. All I know is baby pigs were tested.
I
were harmed in the making of this fact.
Were harmed. That's good. Don't call FEMA. PETA?
PETA. PETA. Also don't call FEMA. Let's do the title of this episode. Don't call FEMA.
Oh, man. There have just been so many emails on the listserv about FEMA that I just...
That's fair. PETA.
I've been re-listening to The Hunger Games because it's one of those Audible books that, like, relaxes me because I've heard it so many times.
Oh, nice.
That's what PETA makes me think of.
Oh, that's fair.
PETA.
Yeah.
And then, back to forensics, guys. Our last question out of this book is... asking about where the best place for sperm detection is.
I literally wrote spermies in my quick description.
Oh, mine was trigger warning.
Trigger warning is also the next thing I was going to say.
Yeah. So actually, this question is asking specifically about sperm recovery from different body cavities, if you will.
Yes.
But actually, the best place for sperm detection is not within a body cavity, but it's dried stains on clothing or skin, which are best visualized with UV light, which is why you never take a UV light into a hotel room.
Nope.
Ever. Don't do it.
Just stay away.
And if it's dried on clothing or skin, the sperm detection can occur for 12 or more months.
Which is really impressive, which they really should take some of this evidence from old rape cases and process it.
Yes, they should. They should do that, but there's not enough funding.
That's true.
I've been listening to this podcast recently called Small Town Dicks, and they actually have an episode. It's about detectives in small towns. Small town dicks.
Yeah.
And they talk about this one case where somebody was the victim of, like, sexual assault / ongoing by a police officer, actually.
Oh.
And she had thought to spit out his semen on a pair of sweatpants and then saved the sweatpants in a closet. She just folded them and put them there.
Interesting.
And they air dried. And they talked specifically on that episode about how if she had put it in a plastic bag, then the evidence would have degraded.
Oh.
Because the plastic bag traps moisture and would allow for the degradation of the semen via, like, mold growth and
things like
that.
Well, that's why with evidence in the forensic context, we often, like... those paper bags that you think about, like the brown lunch bags.
Yeah.
We use those a lot, actually, because they keep things dry.
Yeah.
And there's actually these units in the medical examiner office in the back corner. I don't think they use them all that often, but they're used specifically to dry stuff out.
Yeah.
Like, so essentially there's fans and things that will dry stuff out. So, like, if you have a drowning or something, it's great for drying off those clothing, but also for something like this, it's fantastic.
Yeah, I just thought that was a interesting point that they emphasized in this that was also emphasized on that show. But then in terms of the body, what is the best place to recover semen from?
If this is a person that has a vagina.
Yeah. If this is a person that has a vagina, the vaginal cavity is the best place to recover semen from. The average... length of time that sperm is able to be detected from the vaginal cavity is 38 hours, which I really don't want to know what studies they got these numbers
from. Yeah, no, I was curious. I was wondering if this is one of those things that they had, like, body farm? Like,
but, so then they just took, like, donated sperm and then put it in the various places and tested?
That's the only thing I can imagine that they did. Because I was actually, I distinctly wrote down... imagine that study.
Yeah. I put WTF study is this info from.
I like that we both put it in our notes to be like, what?
Yeah. And then the next best body cavity is the rectum.
Mm-hmm.
Sperm detection lasts for an average of 28 hours.
Yep.
And then the oral cavity is the hostile
site. I love that they use the word hostile.
Yeah.
And in air quotes.
Yep.
Or in quotes.
Well, I put it in air quotes.
I also put it in quotes.
Nice. We have the same brain. And then,
for better or worse.
Probably worse. Probably, definitely worse. And they said that the sperm in this site is degraded within 6 hours. So a fun memory tool that I came up with for this was that the vaginal cavity is, like, designed to keep the sperm alive so it can reach the egg.
Okay.
So, like, that's the best place for sperm detection.
Yep.
The rectum, just next to the vag, you know, in people with vages.
Best.
Yeah, so it's next best. And then the oral cavity is designed to digest stuff.
It is, yeah.
So.
Which does make sense.
Hostile site for sperm.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
I also like that they had a good point of, like, so this is how long the sperm is viable, but they also talked about like seminal fluid, and that's viable for longer. So you can test for things in the seminal fluid, which there's a thing called glycoprotein P30 and acid phosphatase, and these are things that the sperm is swimming in, and that can be detected for longer because these are chemicals or proteins that, you know, just don't degrade as much as like the DNA and the cells that are the sperm.
Yeah, and that, but that'll just tell you that
sperm is present.
Yeah, and not give you any additional information like DNA.
But it is important to know if this person engaged in sexual activity before then.
Oh, for sure.
So that can definitely help you that way.
Yeah.
And finally, we are going to talk about postmortem chemistry, mainly electrolytes. There's a few other things that I took some notes on, but postmortem chemistry is one of those things that they really like to test you on because it is really not great in a lot of ways. Like, essentially, long story short, when you die, when you're alive, your body tries really, really hard to keep things in a very delicate balance. You need more potassium inside your cells than outside of your cells to make various biological processes work. But when you die, that potassium then can leak out of those cells because they aren't working anymore and you're not getting oxygen anymore. So the biggest thing, I think, out of all of this is that potassium is essentially useless postmortem.
Yep.
And once you die, and then, sorry, number one, I would say, is vitreous humor is your friend.
Yes.
Vitreous is better than blood, and potassium is useless. Because once you die, your potassium leaks out of your cells, and it makes your serum potassium go way up.
Yeah.
So do not trust it. In your vitreous, it's slightly less bad, but it's still not great.
Yes. And they have done studies to try to determine, like, calculations for how long has a person been dead based on their potassium level. But a lot of that stuff is like, well, it depends on what their potassium was before they died.
Exactly, so, which you're never going to know.
Yeah.
Sodium's a little bit better, especially in your vitreous fluid.
Yep.
Peripherally, it's okay, but it's pretty good in your vitreous fluid. And chloride is similar. Chloride is kind of helpful, but not great. And then the other one I'm going to mention is glucose, and that's sugar. And as we know, when you die, bacteria go on a feeding frenzy and they start eating all your glucose that's sitting around. Mm-hmm. So peripherally, glucose will go down because bacteria are eating it. You're also decomposing, so things are breaking down into glucose. So it's not great. If you have really, really high glucose, it might be helpful because you can be like, well, it was so high that bacteria weren't able to eat it all by this point. But like we said, in the vitreous, it is slightly better.
Another one that's pretty stable is the BUN.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, which is a marker essentially for kidney function.
Yes. Urea nitrogen.
Yeah.
It's a particular way that nitrogen is stored in the body, which is stuff that we want to pee out.
Yeah. So that's fairly stable. So if that is off of normal, it can tell you that, like, hey, this person had either high levels, which is uremia, or was lower levels, which could be indicative of some other disease process. Yeah. But
and then there are some patterns. Again, these are all to be taken with a grain of salt.
Nah.
Get it?
You love
nah.
it. Nah.
Sodium. I love you, but I hate you. So, as we said, sodium, chloride, and urea are more helpful. So, when you are dehydrated, so you have less water, these levels might be elevated compared to normal. So, if in your vitreous you have elevated sodium, chloride, and urea, it could be a dehydration picture. Again, none of these are absolute. There's a lot of other things that could happen.
Yep.
In decomp, as we've said, increase potassium. Best way to, like, long-term decomp, increase potassium, sodium, and chloride will go down. The other two that I wanted to point out were, diabetic ketoacidosis versus a non-ketotic diabetic coma. So in diabetic ketoacidosis, you're going to have high levels of these things called ketones, as well as really high glucose. So ketones are kind of stable, and then, like we said, high glucose can tell you something. So if you have really high glucose, really high ketones, you might want to think about diabetes. But if you have really high glucose with a dehydration pattern, it might be something called a non-ketotic diabetic coma, which happens more often in people with type 2 diabetes than type 1. The other thing that's important is people in type 2 diabetes who get hyperglycemic get way more hyperglycemic than type 1 diabetics. So if you have a pretty high glucose, like 500, that's probably a type 1 diabetic. But if it's in with the thousands, that's probably a type 2 diabetic. So hopefully you guys either learned something or something that we said stuck and will, you know, help when you're actually on the board exam.
And we will try really hard to get all of the stuff posted to social media, at least before board starts happening for folks, which I think is April 28th is the first day. So
yes,
we still have a couple of weeks.
Literally 2 weeks. This isn't okay. Or I guess it's 2 weeks from when this is being released. Recorded.
Oh, recorded. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because it doesn't get released until next Wednesday.
Lovely.
It is currently Thursday, April 15th, if y'all are curious.
So, at 8:08.
If you really want to know.
And we're at, just kidding, I'm not going to give you the address.
Don't give me my address.
Oh, well, you're here for not my address. So if you want to meet Cole, you can just come on down.
She'll be playing with her paper. Yeah. I think she's currently just under the paper.
She is. She's just hanging out chilling under the paper.
So weird. If you want to check out Cole under her paper, you can check out her Instagram at Cole_Kitty. And then we can also talk about our social meds.
Yeah. So if you like this episode or any of our other episodes, please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. It's how we get boosted up on the various podcasting platforms and other people hear about us.
You can visit our website at deadmendotellpodcast.com, where we linked all of our sources in our episode guide.
On Twitter, we're at deadmendo.
On our Insta, it's at The Dead Tell Tales.
And we have a Facebook page, Dead Men Do Tell Tales Podcast.
And as always, you can send us an email with questions, comments, concerns, boards, questions. We'll hopefully respond a little quicker for that kind of thing, either through our website or directly to thedeadtelltales@gmail.com.
Yes, be very patient with us when it comes to the email. We are not good at answering very quickly.
Please, we try.
Although, we're if bad. It's a boards question, we'll probably answer faster because it's also helping us study.
Yes.
Selfish, I know. But what can you do?
I love when our co-residents ask us random forensics questions because then it leads to our learning. It's awesome.
Yeah. It also makes me feel like somewhat of an expert.
Yes, exactly.
Like, oh, people have confidence in my knowledge. Like that, oh.
Or in my Googling skills.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's all of CP anyway. Our opening theme music is Introducing the Pre-Roll by Leah Rosevere, who you can find on SoundCloud.
Thanks so much, guys. If you are taking board shortly, best of luck.
Yes.
We send you all the good vibes.
And we are suffering right there with you.
Good luck, everyone.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye. Welcome to Dead Men Do Tell Tales.
Yes. A podcast about forensic pathology related topics.
This should definitely go at the end of the episode.